This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
Tonight from 6, now playing with Tom Robinson. At 4, Terry Hall.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Right now, it's Guy Garvey's Finest Hour.
Talking Heads, the book I read. A book theme song for a book theme programme, because this week the Finest Hour is a tour of the libraries of my beloved Manchester. I'm in the street outside John Ryland's library in Manchester, which is the first on a tour of libraries that this show is going to be all about. I'm touring Manchester's libraries. They are beautiful buildings, they are treasure troves, they're parts of our history. They celebrate the things that Manchester's done first. They also celebrate world achievements of one kind or another. They also remind us of our gloomier hours and things that we shouldn't be that proud of. John Ryland's library is a huge, imposing Gothic presence right on the street in Deansgate, but it's very, very beautiful and ornate inside, and it's got an incredible collection of very important texts. So we're going to nip in here now into John Ryland's, the first in our whistle stop tour of Manchester's libraries. I'm Guy Garvey, the lead singer of Humble, and this is my library special. We're going in. I'm now in the main reading room of the beautiful John Ryland's library. I've always thought it should be called Mrs. Ryland's library, because it was really her that decided to pour all the husband's fortune into purchasing huge collections of books for the good of everybody in the country, really. She intended it to be a theological library only. She wanted religious texts, and she was a Christian, Enriqueta Ryland. But yeah, she built this place. It looks very much like a church, but then she decided it was a church for everyone. It was a place of pilgrimage for anyone interested in learning in any way. And on one end of this huge, beautiful sculpted ceiling, looks just like a chapel. There's the religious window, I guess. You can see Moses and Augustus up there. And then at the other end, you've got the arts window with Socrates, Wordsworth, Handel and Plato represented in stained glass in quite a saintly fashion, just like you would normally in a church. Really is a beautiful room, and This place was opened in 1900. It was one of the first public buildings in Manchester to be electrically lit. In actual fact, during some restoration work in recent years, it was found that some of the original light bulbs still worked after 100 and however many years. So yes, lots of fascinating things about this university, but being a boy, I'm interested in the fact that it was an early electrically lit building. It really is a fantastic and beautiful room, and we're going to talk to Julianne Simpson, who's the Rare Books and Maps Manager here at Mrs. Ryland's Library. She's going to show us two very rare and precious biblical texts. So it's Sunday, so if you've not been to church this morning, listen carefully and let yourself off the hook.
Listen, has it raining? Just listen, has it raining? All day, all night, all night, all day. Just listen, has it raining? Just listen, has it raining? Just listen, has it raining? Some moaning, some groaning, some groaning, some praying. Well, oh. Into the south, into the east, into the west, all day, all night, all day. Just listen, hot raining. Just listen, hot raining. Oh, listen, hot raining. Some praying, some crying, some running, some moaning. Will you listen? Has raining, just listen, has raining, just listen, has raining, didn't it rain, children? Rain on my Lord, I did not, did not, I did not, oh my Lord, didn't it rain, 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 rain.
So back in the reading room at John Ryland's Library, and I'm talking to Julianne Simpson, who's the Rare Books Manager here, and you've got a couple of very old, very important texts to show us. Can you tell us what we've got here?
We can start with the Gutenberg Bible.
Yeah, let's do that. Just to describe the Bible for you, it's about a foot and a half long, very ornate, with gold-edged paper. So this was actually early printing then?
This is the first complete printed book produced by Johann Gutenberg, produced in Europe. There was printing earlier than that in China and Korea especially, but this is the first time that printing is being used in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's in the 1450s.
It's a very beautiful thing. Having this book in Manchester, having this very early version of a printed Bible in Manchester, what do you think culturally it contributes to the place? What does it bring people from far and wide, this particular book?
It sort of acts as an ambassador for the library and Manchester, and what a significant place it has been, and all of these cultural institutions that were founded in the 19th century.
So let's have a look at what else we have over here.
I'd like to introduce my colleague Caroline Checkley-Scott, who is head of collection care here, and she's going to talk about the papyri that we have got out for you.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Hi. Roberta Mazza, who's the research fellow here, did work on these two pieces. So the first one is, it's been in the news recently because it's one of the earliest depictions, or at least references to the Last Supper. It's from the 6th century, and it's actually in this particular piece of glass, and because it had been rolled up and tied around somebody's neck as an amulet, so they would use it as a protection piece. But the thing that's interesting is that it's probably the earliest times that people were starting to use the Bible as an amulet, as opposed to kind of magic and things like that.
It's this one, is it? The large one. So you have a large piece of papyrus that's obviously been folded or rolled,
It, yeah, and it could have been tied around somebody's neck with a piece of string or a piece of leather or put into a locket. And people would wear it close to them as a kind of a protection against evil or whatever. The other one beside it sort of is 4th century Coptic. And this is particularly interesting because you can actually see that it was at least in the shape of what we consider to be a book shape nowadays. And this was a book that a magician would have used in the 4th century Coptic Egypt to try and predict the future through the sort of the things that were happening in people's bodies. So this particular one actually says, and I'm quoting Roberta Mazza on this. This isn't my translation.
Yeah.
If your anus twitches, then something bad will happen. But I think we probably know that anyway.
Not always. There's good twitches and bad, I find. This is amazing. 4th century physiology. Brilliant. So, Julianne, we've also got one of Charles Wesley's own hymn books here, one of his own copies of his hymn book. What can you tell us about this?
John and Charles Wesley were, in the 18th century, both decided that they weren't happy worshipping in the Church of England. So particularly John led this new movement called Methodist that wanted to go back to basics. And one of the aspects of that that was important to them was the sort of group activity of singing. And it was actually John's brother Charles who started writing hymns for himself, and these were published. The first edition is 1739, and this is a later edition from 1745 that Charles owned himself, and he's added extra pages in and is writing new hymns in there as well, or playing around with the words.
Well, I can relate to his frustrations there. It's something that I find myself doing an awful lot. In fact, much to the frustration of the rest of my band, I'm still augmenting the words to songs that I wrote 10 years ago. Usually under the influence on a stage, yeah. This is in his handwriting in this edition of the book. He's put a version of Hark the Herald Angels Sing, which he wrote, but it's different. Tell us about how it differs.
So it starts with Hark how all the welkin rings, and welkin even in the 18th century was an old-fashioned word which meant the heavens.
Welkin, and that's W-E-L-K-I-N. For those etymology freaks out there. Hark how all the welkin rings, glory to the King of Kings.
After his death, the hymn book kept being published and other people kept rewriting things as well and trying to perfect them. So this one, the words were changed to Hark the Herald Angels Sing. In the 19th century, Felix Mendelssohn wrote some music which was then put to the words.
Thank you very much for looking after us, Julianne. Thank you, Caroline. So we're going to head over to Central Library to continue our tour of Manchester Libraries. And as I'm looking at the original lyrics to Hark the Herald Angels Sing, written down in front of me in Charles Wesley's own hymn book, let's hear Bob Dylan's version. Let's hear how much it's changed since he wrote it. It's Dylan's version of Hark How All the Welkin Ring. Right, yeah.
Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King. He's on earth and mercy mild, God and sin reconciled.
If you've been brushed by fame, you may be able to make a claim. Just make a call to the Small Claims Court. Six Music listener, Kevin Waddingham.
In the mid-1980s, I was sat next to Brian Clough, who gave me a polo mint. And I took it, whispered very quietly, thank you, and nothing more was done or said about it.
And Julia Hanson.
I left my office and walked into the corridor. Walking towards me was Brian Ferry. He was lost and asked me the way, and I was so starstruck, I completely misdirected him.
Court will resume tomorrow morning from 7. Order, order. The Sean Keaveney Breakfast Show.
Six Music.
If you can't buy books, then a library is really important. It's a place of study, but it's also a place of detailed reference. The magnificent collections that are in all Manchester libraries are the focus of today's programme. A very, very personal attachment to the building we're about to enter. The Central Library is right next to Manchester's Town Hall. It was designed beautifully. It's a great big rotunda. They've done a beautiful job of refurbishing this library, and it's actually, I got what they call a hard hat tour of this place when it was being renovated last year, and I was so inspired by what they've done. They've kept all the beautiful features of this place, which you'll hear more about as we go inside, but they've also made it a very modern place as well. Libraries don't need protecting because of the history of libraries as much as the future of libraries. They're becoming a different place. They're becoming a place that people can come and sit and meet and talk. There's all kinds of different things nationwide going on in libraries. It's becoming a thing of community again. It's not just about old books, is my point. So the library was first opened in 1934 George V opened the library, and he declared to the crowd, "The splendid building which I'm about to open, the largest library in the country, provided by a local authority. In it, the corporation have ensured for the inhabitants of the city magnificent opportunities for further education and for the pleasant use of leisure. I myself used to come in here to scribble early bad sixth form poetry and also have a little nosy through the archives from time to time." Ewan McCall, the songwriter, political activist, the father of Kirsty McCall, he said of the place, "The new central library, which replaced the chicken house, was an imposing circular structure with an enormous reading room, a small theatre and corrals where serious students could carry on their research without interruption. The portico of the magnificent edifice quickly became a popular rendezvous, and meet you at the ref became a familiar phrase on the lips of students, lovers and unemployed youths. I was there on the opening day and on many days thereafter. The ref played an important part in my life, for I made many friends there." We're going to go in, so I'll see you after this. Bye, Ewan McCall, and the news.
I've been over Snowdon, I've slept up on Croydon, I've camped by the Wainstones as well. I've sunbathed on Kinder, been burned to a cinder, and many more things I can tell. My rucksack has oft been my pillow, the heather has oft been my bed. And sooner than part from the mountains, I think I would rather be dead. I'm a rambler from Manchester way. I get all my pleasure the Hartmoorland way. I may be a wage slave on Monday, but I am a free man on Sunday. The day was just ending and I was descending down Grinsbrook just by Upper Tor, when a voice cried, "Hey you, in the waykeepers do heed the worst face that ever I saw." The things that he said were unpleasant, in the teeth of his fury I said, "Sooner than part from the mountains, I think I would rather be dead. I'm a rambler from Manchester way. I get all my pleasure the Hartmoorland way. I may be a wage slave on Monday, but I am a free man on Sunday." He called me a louse and said, "Think of the grouse." Well, I thought, but I still couldn't see why old Kinder Scout and the moors round about couldn't take both the poor grouse and me. He said, "All this land is my master's." At that I stood shaking my head. No man has the right to own mountains any more than the deep ocean bend. I'm a rambler from Manchester way. I get all my pleasure the Hartmoorland way. I may be a wage slave on Monday, but I am a free man on Sunday. I once loved a maid, a spot welder by trade. She was fair as the rowan in bloom, and the blue of her eye matched the June moorland sky, and I wooed her from April till June. On the day that we should have been married, I went for a ramble instead. For sooner than part from the mountains, I think I would rather be dead. I'm a rambler from Manchester way. I get all my pleasure the Hartmoorland way. I may be a wage slave on Monday, but I am a free man on Sunday. So I'll walk where I will, over mountain and hill, and I'll lie where the bracken is deep. I belong to the mountains, the clear running fountains, where the grey rocks rise rugged and steep. I've seen the white hare in the gullies, and the curlew fly high overhead. and sooner than far from the mountains. I think I would rather be dead. I'm a rambler from Manchester way. I get all me pleasure the hard moorland way. I may be a wage slave on Monday, but I am a free man on Sunday.
News. Six Music. This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 2:30. I'm Adam Porter. Extremists from the group Islamic State claim to have beheaded the American hostage Peter Kasich. In a video posted online, the militant group said it killed the 26-year-old aid worker who'd converted to Islam because of the West's military intervention in Iraq. Mr. Kasich's parents say they're waiting for confirmation from the government about the authenticity of the footage, but wanted their son to be remembered for his important work. The Conservative Party chairman is Grant Shapps.
It just defies any kind of understanding about, you know, human behaviour. And I think it emphasises why we're right to take a stand on this, why we're right to have the RAF involved there as well.
Five teenagers have died following a crash near Doncaster last night. Two cars collided on the A630 in Conisbrough. A 21-year-old man who was arrested has been released on bail. The G20 summit has closed in Brisbane with a pledge to boost growth. World leaders agreed to try to go for growth of at least 2.1% by 2018. They also announced strong action on climate change. Prison officers in England and Wales are to receive greater protection from violent inmates under new plans announced by the Ministry of Justice. Figures show serious assaults are a record high, and unions say 90 wardens a month are leaving. Francis Crook is the chief executive of the Howard League for Penal Reform.
What the government should be doing is looking at preventing people from taking their own lives, preventing the violence in the first place. That means you have to reduce the numbers of prisoners, and you have to support and resource staff, because they're the people who work with prisons and they're the people who we need to support.
The Nigerian army says it's retaken control of Chibok 48 hours after Islamist militants from Boko Haram attacked the town. More than 200 schoolgirls were abducted from there in April. 150,000 birds have been destroyed at a farm in the Netherlands after a strain of bird flu was found there. A local ban on the transportation of poultry has been imposed. That's Six Music News. The next update's at 3:30.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
6 Music.
So I'm here in the beautiful cavernous foyer with its beautiful stained glass windows and its ornate ceiling of Manchester Central Library, And I'm delighted to see again Neil McInnes, who showed me around this place when it was still under construction. Neil is the head of Library and Information Services at Manchester City Council. Nice to see you again, Neil.
Nice to see you too, Guy, and I'm delighted you could come along today.
You're going to take us up to the great big grand reading room.
Indeed, follow me, Guy, and we'll go into the books and reading hall.
Echo and the Bunnymen and Read It in Books. Echo, quite a poignant choice, actually, that word, because I'm peering into the central reading room, the Great Hall, which is the dome of Manchester Central Library. Beautiful marble pillars all the way around, a gorgeous Art Deco clock reminiscent of the one in the middle of Grand Central Station. There's glass cabinets with some of the library's treasures on display for people to look at. And the reason I'm not going to do this link in the reading room is because there are students at study as we speak, using the place as it was intended. But Neil's still here. Can I start off, Neil? What to you are the most important things culturally that the library contributes to Manchester life?
I often describe the library as the city's living room. But it's also the city study as well. And one of the things that I love as you wander around the library is you see people using the space as they see fit. Mm. So we're outside the fantastic Whispering Gallery that is the reading room, but we're also sitting now at a lovely little soft seating reading lounge. So the library is literally the living room and the study of the city.
Tell us some of the great minds that have used this library. How has it contributed to Manchester's cultural wealth?
Morrissey studied for his A-levels in this building. Anthony Burgess, the author, also studied in the library. And Sir John Barbaroli was a visitor to the library as well. So it's hard actually to have a conversation where people haven't been in the library.
It's topped by a dome. Tell us about the glass of the dome. What was the discovery concerning its opaqueness?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the dome probably hadn't been cleaned for 80 years. So actually what we've managed to do is replaced each item from the lantern. And now, on a beautiful sunny day in Manchester, the room is beautifully lit.
Well, thank you, Neil. We're going to leave these studious, brilliant young minds to do their thing. And we're going to go over to the Henry Watson Music Library, I believe.
You can read a storybook. You can turn from page to page. But there call love. So long. Take a lesson from a teacher. Yeah, yeah. If you don't
was your storybook. Now that you turn from page to page, but there is no end to the story called love.
The story called love.
So we're here in the Henry Watson Music Library section of Central Library. You can probably hear a couple of pieces of music behind me going on. That's students from BIM, which is the British and Irish Institute of Modern Music. Those guys are just jamming away in a corner. They've got an electronic drum kit and a load of amplifiers and guitars. And astonishingly, you can't hear a whisper in the central reading room, which is adjacent to it. They've done a great job of soundproofing the place. The library's named after Dr. Henry Watson, a renowned composer and teacher born in nearby Accrington. And he gave his private collection to Manchester City Council in 1902. That was 16,700 volumes. We're going to walk over and talk to Roz Edwards, who's a music librarian here at the Central Library. She's going to show us some more rare treasures. Hi, Roz, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
So you've got some treasures to show us.
I certainly have. They're in this room here.
Great. So you can hear that. We've come into this little room, and as the door shuts, the music is cancelled out. And them lads shredding away in there, and it's a beautiful afternoon. These huge windows letting the sun shine in. So, Roz, you've got some treasures to show us. What's the first thing that you've got? The first thing I've got
is an autograph of George Frederick Handel from our big collection of Handel manuscripts.
Wow.
This dates from 1749.
Wow. And I'm going to read this out to the best of my ability. It's in a small book with yellowing pages. That's his handwriting, is it?
It is indeed, yes.
I feel better about my own handwriting, actually, looking at this. It says, I intend to perform this oratorio at the Theatre Royal in Covent Garden, George Friedrich Handel.
Yeah.
It's a very, what would you call it? It's a very straightforward autograph, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's
I intend to perform this oratorio.
Yes.
So tell us about the Handel manuscripts.
We've got a collection of about 368 Handel manuscripts. They're from a collection that was put together by a gentleman called Charles Jennings, who wrote the libretto to Messiah.
Wow.
So he was a collaborator of Handel's, and he had his own library of Handel manuscripts.
That's amazing. What an amazing thing to have in the city as well.
Indeed, it's very rare to have such a complete Handel catalogue.
So, what else have we got here then? Some more treasures.
This is some Vivaldi violin sonatas. It has his autograph on the title page. He didn't actually copy the music. He had a copyist to do that. But he actually wrote on the title page that it was by him.
This is amazing. So, I'm stood in front of something that he wrote down. Could you read it out for us?
Sonata a violino solo a basso per il cembalo del signor Antonio Vivaldi.
Wonderful. It really is wonderful. Now, he's got quite nice handwriting, hasn't he?
He has lovely handwriting.
Handel, not so much. Vivaldi, much better.
It'll be around the 1720s, probably.
What a wonderful thing, yes, to be stood in front of.
Well, the Vivaldi sonatas, sometimes called the Manchester sonatas, were discovered in Manchester. That's why they got that name, by a gentleman who's now a retired professor at Liverpool University. They came as part of the Handel collection, but were somewhat neglected by its previous owner, who was only interested in Handel. There are 12 sonatas, and some of them are unique to this book, so they've not... a lot of 18th century composers used to write bits, and they'll write another bit which will turn up in another work.
Isn't that amazing? I wonder if we can find a recording of one for you to listen to now.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had something of a love affair with the vibe of libraries.
Stuart McConey's Freak Zone.
I educated myself about more left field and experimental and unusual music largely through my public libraries in Wigan. I borrowed everything from Bartok String Quartets to Hammond Dull and Krautrock Records.
Six Music.
This weekend on the Freak Zone, I'll be raiding the music room again like I did all these years ago, but this time at Manchester Central Library. I'll be speaking to Matthew Bourne and Christophe de Bezenac about a brilliant installation they've got there. I'll be wandering around and rekindling my love affair with the record library, and we'll be just generally wallowing in the pleasures that a good library can give you.
Stuart McConey's Freak Zone.
A library special. Tonight at 8 p.m. as part of Six Music Celebrates Libraries.
Elvis Costello, Every Day I Write the Book. And before that, you heard Vivaldi. We just saw the original score in the Henry Watson Library here at Manchester Central Library, the second library on our tour, We've left the music library now and I'm in the vaults. So we've been down a long corridor which has got all that kind of railings on the roof, that sort of modern. You can feel we're in a temperature controlled environment or just outside of one. And I'm here with Daz Rawcliffe, who looks after the ancient artefacts here in Manchester Central Library. Where are we now? What did this used to be before the refurbishment, Daz?
This used to be the library theatre. We're in the lower ground floor. So it was a 300 seat theatre thereabouts, I think, which is now moved out. Various props rooms, various offices, and now it's all been rebuilt as a state-of-the-art archive store.
When you say a state-of-the-art storage, you mean for the preservation of old manuscripts?
Yeah, for the preservation of old manuscripts and books, which is roughly 1850 and before. There's about 50,000 items from 1850 and before here, and lots of plans and archive store material.
Now, I think this is fascinating. While the work was being done on Central Library recently, tell us where a lot of the stuff was stored to keep it safe.
A lot of the stuff was stored in the salt mines. A lot of the very rare stuff was stored in the salt mines, which is something, once the salt is dug out, it's ideal conditions for keeping paper in a paper store. So I always describe it as a gold mine rather than a salt mine, because they get the money for the salt that they dig out, and then they've got a wonderful space left for storing, and they store all sorts of material there. John Rylands, I think you've been there this morning. Mm-hmm. They store a lot of their material down there. And we had our rare stuff there.
See, that's fantastic. This place is a mile down and the size of several football pitches, isn't it?
Yep.
And you've got all these rare treasures from Manchester's library stored there.
We have, yeah, which you can have a look at now if you're ready.
Yes, please.
Okay.
I'm looking at huge shelves. They're those mobile units that... Are they electronically controlled, these days?
Yes, they're all electronically controlled.
Can I move one?
Yeah, sure.
Can I move this one?
Absolutely, just press the button.
So these are huge steel bookshelves... Oh, listen to that. I do like gears and pulleys.
So every 4 hours or so during the night, they move themselves.
Really?
Yeah, they sort of shift a bit. Scared the life out of the security guard the first time it happened, but so it just keeps things
so
even.
So all these huge bookshelves automatically move themselves?
Yes, oh, every so often they will move and keep the air circulating.
That's fascinating. Just looking now at some of the huge tomes that are stretching up to the ceiling in this massive space. Manchester Prince's Theatre Playbills,
yeah.
1909 to 37 is the first. And there's hundreds of these.
There is. I mean, we have lots of different special collections, some quite quirky and some individual that individuals have had an enthusiasm for over the years.
Tell us about the oldest book that we've got here.
This book, I'll show you the oldest book. We do have something older than this. This is the Codex Justinianus, which is a 5th century law code. But it's one of the books which was lost in the Dark Ages, so it's rediscovered in the 13th century. So this is actually 13th century.
So where was it found?
When we opened in the 1850s, the library always had a policy of buying rare books, so it was just acquired over the years. We haven't got a great deal of information on the provenance of some of the books, but there was a policy in the early days, certainly, of buying rare materials. We do have an older object. We have a 12th century block of wood with the Quran on it, which I haven't got out, but this is the oldest book. This is the oldest handwritten book we have, and this is 13th century, written in Latin.
Oh, how beautiful.
It is. It's absolutely lovely. So the actual text of this book is just the two columns in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is just additional comments by scholars. And you'll see as I turn the pages, they're all by different hands and different individuals, whether it was monks or whoever owned the book at one time or another.
That's absolutely fascinating. The text actually looks like it's been deliberately centralised to encourage marginality.
Yeah, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it does look like that. And like I say, there are lots of different comments, all in Latin, by various different hands throughout the work. So that's... 13th century, so that's 800, 900 years.
And it's a law book?
It's a law book, yeah, it's a Roman law code.
That's fascinating.
So that's originally written in the 5th century, but this copy is 13th century.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law? Well, you see, I didn't really mean you any harm, but I simply couldn't make it on the farm. When the land won't give a lot, you gotta do with what you got, and all I got's the muscle in my arm. Well, I wouldn't ever hurt my fellow man, and mister, seems to me you'd understand. I'm just trying to help myself without hurting anybody else, and a man has got to do the best he can.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law. Who is weak, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law? Oh, I didn't really mean to let my family down, and I'm not giving you the runaround. I'd rather be dead than to have to bake my daily bread and I pay my way no matter where I'm bound. Well, I didn't really think that I did wrong. Just as long as I stayed here where I belong, I did the only thing I could, same as anybody would. Yes, I was simply trying to get along. On this side of the law, on that side of the law. Who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law?
Show us the last thing that you've got for us here then, Dan.
Look at this. This is a Shakespeare second folio.
That very, very famous image of Shakespeare in the flyleaf.
Yeah, this is published 1632. The first one was 1623, I think. So everything after his death, all of it was published after his death. Shakespeare, generally speaking, wasn't that interested in publication of his works. He made his money from the performance. So he sold the rights to his works for publication to a number of different publishers. They did the printing of the copies later on after he died. The second folio is famous because of this poem, really, which is written by Milton. So this was the first appearance in print of a Milton poem.
Wow.
Milton's father was involved a little bit in the publication of the first folio. This is the second folio with his first poem.
So this the first time that poem appeared in print?
Yeah, that's the first time a Milton poem appeared in print.
Any Milton poem, yeah. What need my Shakespeare for his honoured bones, the labour of an age in piled stones, or that his hallowed relic should be hid under a flare?
Starry pointed
pyramid. That's the old F tripping me up there, isn't it? The old S, I should say. Dear son of memory, great heir of fame, what needest thou such dull witness of thy name? All right, so a little bit of mourning the loss of Shakespeare there. What an amazing thing. This is another really beautiful big old tome. And is this everything Shakespeare wrote?
Yes, it is. There are different, the second and the first folio, there were about 1,700 differences, so it was being revised all the time, but it is a complete works, essentially, yeah, that's Henry VI, as you can see.
Wonderful. It's becoming a little bit of a theme, actually, that I wasn't expecting, the fact that great works change down the ages as people get their hands on them.
Yep, absolutely, yeah.
Caught between the twisted stars, the plotted lines, the faulty map that brought Columbus to New York. Betwixt between the east and west, he calls on her wearing a leather vest. The earth squeals and shudders to a halt. A diamond crucifix in his ear is used to help ward off the fear that he has left his soul in someone's rented car. Inside his pants he hides a mop to clean the mess that he has dropped into the life of lightsome Juliet Bell. And Romeo wanted Juliet, and Juliet wanted Romeo, and Romeo wanted Juliet, and Juliet wanted Romeo. Romeo Rodriguez squares his shoulders and curses Jesus, runs a comb through his black ponytail. He's thinking of his lonely room, the sink that by his bed gives off a stink, then smells her perfume in his eyes, and her voice was like a bell. Outside the streets were steaming, the crack dealers were dreaming of a Uzi somewhere near to score. I bet you I can hit that light with my one good arm behind my back, says little Joey Diaz. Brother, give me another tote. Those downtown hoods are no damn good. Those Italians need a lesson to be taught. This cop who died in Harlem, you think they get the warning? I was dancing when I saw his brains run out on the street. And Romeo had Juliet, and Juliet had Romeo. And Romeo had Juliet, and Juliet. Juliet had a Romeo. I'll take Manhattan in a garbage bag with Latin written on it that says, it's hard to give a shit these days. Manhattan sinking like a rock until the filthy Hudson, what a shock. They wrote a book about it, they said it was like ancient Rome. The perfume burned his eyes, holding tightly to her thighs, and something flickered for a minute, and then it vanished and was gone.
BBC Radio 6 Music. This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
The book of love is long and boring. No one can lift the damn thing. It's full of charts and facts and figures and instructions for dancing. But I love it. Book of Love has music in it. In fact, that's where music comes from. Some of it's just transcendental. Some of it's just really dumb. But I love it when sing to me, and you can sing me anything. Of love is long and boring and written very long ago. It's full of flowers and heart-shaped boxes and things we're all too young to know. But I love it when you things, and you ought to give me wedding rings, and I love it when you give me things. Give me wedding rings. You are to give me wedding rings.
So one of the main rooms in the Central Library, one of the new rooms, just off the cafeteria, is the archives. This is the modern, I suppose, the most changed part of Central Library. And we're in Archives Plus. And I'm with Marion Hewitt, who's director of the Northwest Film Archive. And Nicholas Royal, Manchester author. And, I'm going to talk to Nicholas in a minute. But first of all, Marion, describe this little area we're sat in now.
Well, we're sitting in what we're calling film pods, and there are several of these. Northwest Film Archive has a couple, and the rest are the BFI Mediatek. And this is where you can drop into Archives Plus and sit and watch films.
These are sort of circular, high-walled, almost diner-esque booths with interactive touch screens in the middle of them.
There are 450-odd films in there, but we've got like 7,500 in the catalogue.
Wow. Yeah. So, this is an amazing progressive attitude to turn a library into something so fascinating in a modern way as well. The whole idea is that you can just stumble in here, start pushing buttons, and find something of local historical interest.
The collection we hold represents life in the Northwest from the 1890s to the present day. So you can see what jobs people used to do, all the local industries, where they went on holiday, whit walks, local markets, all kinds of things, lots of home movies, newsreels.
We're watching a film here in the film pods. This is really rather comfortable. I think I could lose hours of my life here. In fact, producer of this program, Elizabeth Olker, told me that she did exactly that. She spent a long time in here the first time she came down. I'm with Nicholas Royal, who's... are you happy with Manchester author, or do you prefer English author?
No, English author makes me feel a bit weird, actually. I like Manchester author, definitely.
Hello, Nicholas. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, Guy, thanks, yeah.
We've just been talking about how neither of us prioritises our first order of business very well, but you are in the middle of writing your eighth novel at the moment.
Yes, I'm writing my eighth novel. It's called Second Album, so it has a lot to do with music, so I'm very interested to see this, what there is here in the Northwest Film Archive. It's kind of taking me back, or I suspect that it might take me back to my youth when I was going to gigs at the Apollo in the late 70s.
Were you a Roxy Music fan? We're just watching archive footage from a film made in Manchester Polytechnic, it was announced at the front of the programme. We're watching people getting ready to go and see Roxy Music in, what would it be, the late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah, it's got to be late 70s, this, I think. I was a fan of Roxy.
Did you dress the part? Did you...
no, well, apart from the little round dark glasses that Ron Mayall wore, I always wanted, and these days I'm there.
You're so chic, do you ever love me? Ravens of the mountain streamline, midnight you can see in the floors. Dance the cha-cha through to sunrise, opens up exclusive doors. For wow, just like the windows look the same. So me and you, just me too, got to search for something new. We'll be right back.
Plain.
That was Virginia Plain by Roxy Music. A favourite of yours, is it, Marion?
Definitely, yeah, I was a big fan.
So my granddad, who used to bring me past this building and tell me that I owned it and every book in it, also used to do the same with the Free Trade Hall and the Town Hall. The Free Trade Hall isn't there anymore. In fact, it's now a hotel. I was out of town. Didn't happen on my watch. But, yeah, the Free Trade Hall was famously a venue where the Sex Pistols played for the first time when playing in Manchester. It's part of a lot of musical, recent musical history, I guess. Have you got any films pertaining to the Free Trade Hall in the archive?
There's a film made for the city called A City Speaks, and it was made in the 1940s to show the citizens of Manchester where their rates were being spent and what the city was doing for them, how it was going to redevelop after the Blitz damage and post-war. And there are scenes in the Free Trade Hall, the Royal Exchange, the Town Hall.
Wow.
And there's a cracking sequence of all the leisure activities in Manchester, Bellevue, King's Hall, John Barbarolli conducting the Halle, all that sort of thing.
That's marvellous. I think we should have a look at that. So we're going to watch this film on the history of the Free Trade Hall, exactly where the rates for the people of Manchester were going, what the council were doing them, the corporation were doing them. For my generation, the Free Trade Hall is important because, as legend has it, when the Sex Pistols played there and they were invited to play the Free Trade Hall in Manchester by the Buzzcocks, who we're going to hear from in a second, that gig apparently was attended by quite a lot of Manchester musicians. Apparently there was members of the Stone Roses, Tony Wilson, who went on to do Factory, New Order, there was loads of them. Apparently all went on to form bands after seeing that legendary gig. How much truth there is in that, I'll leave up to you to decide. Just bear in mind that it's a story from this city, so it's not necessarily true. But we're going to hear from the Buzzcocks now, and we're going to have... you've picked this tune, haven't you, Nicholas?
Yes. Ever fallen in love with someone you shouldn't have fallen in with?
There we go. If you're angry about me saying that you're a liar over appearing at the Free Trade Hall gig where the Sex Pistols were on with the Buzzcocks, guy.6music@bbc.co.uk. Here are the Buzzcocks with an introduction from Pete Shelley himself.
Because Manchester always used to have this thread of, like, poets, and like comedians would be doing things, you know, so... the scene in Manchester wasn't so much about the music. It was about everything else. There was no, like, clothes designers involved in punk in Manchester. So it became first about things like William Burroughs. You know, so it became something which has had some kind of literary appeal to it.
Someone ever fall in love in love with someone you should have fallen in love.
So we're still in our film pod and we're still watching A City Speaks in the background. Nicholas Royle is with me. He's a Manchester author. So you're writing your eighth novel at the moment.
Yeah, I'm writing my eighth novel, which follows my seventh, quite reasonably, but my seventh was called First Novel. And this new novel I'm writing now is called Second Album.
And like a second album, it's taking you forever.
It's taking me forever and proving very difficult. Yeah. And that's partly because I just don't manage my time very well. I do a lot of different things, all to do with writing and editing and publishing. And I tend to prioritise all the other ones rather than the one that I should prioritise.
And I've already admitted to Nicholas that I do exactly the same thing. Here I am making radio programmes when I should be writing records. How important is the Central Library, in fact all of Manchester's libraries, how important are they to you as both a resident of the city and as somebody that's making the work that will one day fill them?
Well, I came here as a boy. I absolutely loved this place. I haunted it. I came here for my own interest, to research my own interests and to research stuff for my schoolwork. And so I spent a lot of time up on the top floor where I've been, well, I think it was the top floor, Language and Literature Library.
Do you ever write in public spaces?
I very often, yeah. Where I write on trains, I write in pubs and cafes.
So, Nicholas, in your opinion, has Manchester got a healthy literary scene at the moment?
I think it has a very healthy literary scene, actually. There's lots of exciting young writers. I mean, there are regular reading nights. And there are well-known authors like Gwendolyn Riley and Joe Stretch, who are based in Manchester and writing novels. There are people who are writing short stories based in Manchester. And in Manchester, we have a sense of, not ownership of them, but there's a sense that they can be sort of co-opted onto the Manchester scene.
Mm-hmm.
Libraries, of course, are absolutely key to this. They couldn't be more important. I mean, it shouldn't need stating, but they're full of books. And so, you know, it's where I fostered my love of literature.
Another reason why these buildings are so fantastic is this refurbishment means so much to so many people in Manchester. It's very lovely to see you again, Nicholas.
You too, Gary.
Lots of luck with the book. The title's definite.
The title is definite. It's Second Album.
Second Album. Nicholas Royle's The Second Album.
Hi, this is Terry Hall from The Specials.
Music.
Just playing a few of my favourite records on a Sunday afternoon. I think more than anyone else, David Bowie is the artist who made me want to get into music and probably sing. Everybody's got a favourite period, Bowie. Mine's sort of 1975, 1976, around Young Americans and Station to Station. I saw him perform this on American TV. Following morning, I went into a hairdresser's called Barbarella's in Coventry with a photo of him, and I said, I want my hair like this. This is the future for me. And I came out looking like Bette Lynch.
Terry Hall.
The beauty of doing this radio show on Six Music is that I get 2 hours of playing my favourite records every week.
This afternoon from 4
on BBC Radio Six Music.
You're listening to me, Guy Garvey. This is my library special. We're on a whistle-stop tour of the four main libraries in Manchester City Centre. We've taken a short walk around the corner from Central Library now to the Portico Library on Mosley Street, of which I am a member. Opened in 1806, designed by Thomas Harrison, the English architect and bridge engineer, built in the Greek Revival style, and David Bellhouse, who did much to shape Victorian Manchester, built it as well. The library was established as a result of a meeting of Manchester businessmen in 1802, which resolved to found an institute uniting the advantages of a newsroom and a library. The library's focus is 19th century literature, much of which has actually been purchased around the time, and one of the secretaries was Peter Mark Roget, who began that famous book of his here, The Thesaurus. We're going to go in and see what they got in here.
A winter's day in a deep and dark December, I am alone, gazing from my window to the streets below on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow. I am a rock, I am an island. I've built walls, a fortress deep and mighty that I have no need of friendship. friendship causes pain. It's laughter and it's loving I disdain. Talk of love. Well, I've heard the word before. It's sleeping in my memory. I won't disturb the slumber of feelings that have died. If I never loved, I never would have cried.
I'm now inside the beautiful, secluded little reading room at the far end of the Portico Library from the main entrance. Floor-to-ceiling books in this beautiful old room, an ornate lampshade, an old oak library ladder going up the wall. I've spent a lot of time in here because I'm a member of this library, and here to guide us through the history of the Portico and some of its treasures as well is Emma Mariano, who's the chief librarian at the Portico. And before we go any further, I've got a bit of a ticking off coming my way.
Yes, I think we're just about to put you on the blacklist for not paying your subscription, Guy.
So the Portico is a private member's library, and I've been a member for some years and I've not paid my subscription. I'm doing a programme on Manchester's libraries, all swanky and that, and I haven't paid my subscription. Apologies for that. Elizabeth Gaskell has a strong connection to the library. Do you want to walk us through who she is and how she's connected to this place?
Elizabeth Gaskell is very well known as being one of the great 19th century novelists, and she lived in Manchester and in Knutsford. She is famous for the Portico Library because her husband, the Reverend William Gaskell, greatly shadowed by her, was the longest serving chairman of the Portico Library for 35 years. And unfortunately, Mrs. Gaskell complained in a letter to one of her friends that she had to wait 2 weeks before she could get hold of a magazine from London because she had to let the male proprietors hands on it first. At the time, because of the Married Women's Property Act, married women were not able to be members of the library, because on becoming a member you actually became a proprietor, and as a married woman you could not hold any property or shares in a property. And this is why Mrs. Gaskell wasn't able to be a member.
Well, that is, yeah, cruel, unusual, unfair, and thankfully not the case anymore. So does the library hold some first editions of Elizabeth Gaskell's work?
It does indeed. In fact, we have quite a few first editions of Elizabeth Gaskell's, including Ruth, Wives and Lovers, and indeed North and South.
To think circumstance so wrought that whenever I exult in existence henceforward, I may say to myself, all this gladness in life, all honest pride in doing my work in the world, all this keen sense of being, I owe to her. And it doubles the gladness. It makes the pride glow. It sharpens the sense of existence till I hardly know if it is pain or pleasure.
I'm holding in my hand a first edition of Confessions of an English Opium Eater by Thomas De Quincey. It's about Mark Riley, surely. And what's he? He's got like a connection to this place as well, hasn't he?
Well, the book actually holds a connection to the place more than he does, really, because he mentions a few pages into the book, whilst he was in Manchester, that he was stood on the steps of the porch, a library in Manchester. And that's his connection to the Portico. Unfortunately, we have no evidence that he ever came in.
But we have got a first edition of one of his books right here to have a look at. This is fantastic. Well, we're going to listen to a related track right now. We're going to listen to Opium Tea by Nick Cave, and then we're going to talk to Emma a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Here I sleep the morning through, till the wail of the call to prayer awakes me, and there is nothing at all to do but rise and follow the day wherever it takes me. I stand at the window and I look at the sea, and I am what I am and what will be will be. I stand at the window and I look at the sea, then I make me a pot of opium tea. Down at the port I watch the boats come in. Oh, watch the boats come in can do something to you. And the kids gather round with an outstretched hand, and I toss them a dirham or two. Well, I wonder if my children are thinking of me, 'cause I am what I am and what will be will be. I wonder if my kids are thinking of me, and I smile and I sip my opium tea. At night the sea lashes the rust-red ramparts, and the shapes of hooded men move past me. And the mad moaning wind lives and lives and lives the strange lot the fate has cast me. Well, the cats on the rampart sing merrily that he is what he is and what will be will be. Yeah, the cats on the rampart sing merrily, and I sit and I drink my opium tea. I'm a prisoner here, I can never go home. There is nothing here to win or lose. There are no choices needed to be made at all, not even the choice of heaven to choose. Well, I'm a prisoner here, yes, but I'm also free, 'cause I am what I am and what will be. I'm a prisoner here, yeah, but I'm also free, and I smile and I sip my opium tea.
News.
Six Music. This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 3:30. I'm Adam Porter. David Cameron has said the extremist group Islamic State has yet again shown itself to be a depraved organisation after it claimed to have murdered another Western hostage. The Prime Minister said the American Peter Kassig was a selfless humanitarian worker. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner has seen the video posted online, which hasn't yet been verified, and says it's different from previous ones.
They spare no detail. It's utterly gory and revolting. So they've obviously taken a decision to go full on that one. They also show a lot of the militants unmasked, which is very unusual. Previously, they've always been masked, partly because it looks sinister and partly to disguise their identities.
A man has been arrested after the deaths of five teenagers in a road crash near Doncaster. He's been questioned and released on bail. All those who died were aged between 16 and 18. Police in Glasgow say a car involved in a hit and run in which an 11-year-old girl died had been hired. The driver failed to stop and the car was abandoned after the incident on Friday night. The G20 group of nations have ended their summit in Australia with agreements to boost flagging global growth, tackle climate change and crack down on tax avoidance. But much of the meeting was overshadowed by tensions between the West and Russia over Ukraine. David Cameron's comments that the continued destabilisation of Ukraine by President Putin was unacceptable were echoed by President Obama.
If he continues down the path that he is on, violating international law, providing heavy arms to the separatists in Ukraine, the isolation that Russia is currently experiencing will continue.
The Dutch authorities have banned the movement of eggs and poultry throughout Holland after a strain of bird flu was identified at a farm. 150,000 hens are being destroyed at the poultry farm in the village of Hekkendorp in the central Netherlands. That's Six Music News. The next update's at 4:30.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
6 Music.
Well, I just got out my little red book the minute that you said goodbye. Your charms, and each girl in my little red book knows you're the one I'm thinking of. Oh, won't you please come back? Without your precious love, I can't go on. Where can love be? I need you so much. All I did was talk about you. Hear your name and I start to cry.
I'm Guy Garvey. This could be my finest hour. It's my library special, celebrating libraries with Six Music all this week. I'm now inside the beautiful, secluded little reading room at the far end of the Portico Library from the main entrance. I'm as our tour guide and chief librarian here at the Portico. It has had some famous members, though, hasn't it, the Portico, over the years?
Absolutely.
Can you list a few for us?
Well, Peter Roger, who is best known for his thesaurus, was its first secretary, and it's believed that he may have started writing part of the thesaurus before he moved down to London just a couple of years later. We also have John Dalton, who is known as the father of the atomic theory, amongst other things, was famous in his own time, and we gave him honorary membership in exchange for winding up our clock.
Amazing. Amazing. How do I get honorary membership? What do I have to do?
I think that perhaps you might have to wind up our clock as well.
Okay, I'll think about that. Take us through some of the more famous first editions that you've got here, Emma.
Okay, well, we've got really quite a lot of first editions, because these are all books that were collected by the people who built the library and who bought the books as they came in, but also bought books to impress others. And so, as you can imagine, there are quite a few first editions. We've got quite a few Charles Dickens, we've got Wilkie Collins, we've got Walter Scott's, we've got quite a number of first editions of the well-known 19th century novelists. But we also have some curious first editions. We have coming much, much later into the 20th century, in fact, we have a seventh printing of the first edition of James Joyce's Ulysses, for instance, at a time when it was not able to be published in the United Kingdom. It was published by Shakespeare and Company in Paris. Our particular edition was published in 1925, while the very first one was published in 1921, if I'm not mistaken.
So here I'm getting an atmosphere of a boys' club, a men-only library, which has which has terrible rules concerning women, and yet one good thing to come of blokes hanging around trying to impress one another is that the guys were buying these rare books and perhaps these books that weren't supposed to be out in order to impress one another, like, look what I've got.
Yeah, quite definitely, yes.
So are we aware of where all the books came from? Why are there so many Dickens first editions in here? Will they have come from various members down the years?
Well, they will have been bought as they were coming out, because Dickens actually did publish, first of all, in serials, and then they were published into book form. He was a prolific writer, and he was enormously popular, so you can imagine that any library worth its salt would hold a good few Dickens, and indeed, we have the Dickens too. He was a contemporary of Mrs. Gaskell, and actually she wrote for his Household Words. And he is said to have called her a little bit irritating or a little bit difficult to work with.
Oh, Charlie, keep your wig on. Yeah, well, we're going to hear a piece of music inspired by Charles Dickens. Vaughan Williams was a huge fan, and this next piece of music's based or inspired by A Christmas Carol. Emma, thank you very, very much for showing us round. I'll get my my annual fees in. Yeah, and next time I see you, I'll have a check in my hand. We're going to wander over to Cheetham's, which is the final stop on our tour of Manchester's libraries. We're going to listen to a piece of music by Vaughan Williams, inspired by A Christmas Carol. It's called On a Christmas Night. And here are some of Dickens' own thoughts on music.
Poetry makes life what lights and music do the stage. Thus a strain of gentle music, or the rippling of water in a silent place, or the odour of a flower, or the mention of a familiar word, will sometimes call up sudden dim remembrances of scenes that never were in this life, which vanish like a breath, which some brief memory of a happier existence, long gone by, would seem to have awakened, which no voluntary exertion of the mind could ever recall.
A key of life. Who we were, are, and can be.
A key to let your imagination fly.
A key to knowledge, sharing.
A key for pleasure, for freedom.
On Friday, Steve Lamarck is let loose in the British Library for a radio first and gets to unlock the hidden gems within the National Sound Archive.
Opened by me. A simple key. Your library.
Discover modern music artifacts from The Who, Beatles, Patti Smith to the world's first ever sound recordings.
We gotta do a song that you never heard before.
Plus, sampled Supremo DJ Yoda will be taking up our challenge to create some brand new music using sounds he's uncovered in the library's vaults.
Steve Lamarck, live from the British Library.
Friday at 4 p.m. on BBC Radio 6 Music.
We
across Manchester. As you can hear, there's plenty of people around. It's approaching the rush hour, and lots of elegant and very fastidious looking young people are brushing past me in either direction, because I'm outside Cheetham School of Music, which is a centre of musical excellence for the classically trained in our city. And yes, originally Cheetham's Hospital, it contains a library that was built there in 1653, making it the oldest public library in the English-speaking world. Hey! Now, the most wonderful thing about this is that Marx and Engels, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, were said to write up their list of things to do, the Communist Manifesto, in this very library, and the books they were using, the economics books, can be seen on the shelf in Cheetham's library. However, I spent so long in Manchester's other beautiful libraries that we've missed it, and it's shut. So no dice. Jonathan Schofield, local historian, is going to tell us something about the history of Cheetham.
Walk across the courtyard towards the library.
Hi, guys, it's Jonathan. We're just going to do a tour of Cheetham's library now, show these special buildings.
Neath my feet, ramble up the stairwell to the hall above. Since we got the interweb, these halls.
Libraries don't come more special than Cheetham's Library. Cheetham's Library has history. It has a beautiful collection, and it's got the most atmospheric set of buildings in central Manchester. Whereas the other libraries are from different ages, classical libraries, we've got 1930s libraries and Victorian libraries. This is in a building of the 1420s, so it's truly old. The library dates from the 1650s, when a man called Humphrey Cheetham, not Chetham, Humphrey Cheetham, he gave money to have a school for poor boys in one part of the building, and this ancient library in another part of the building. Well, it wasn't ancient at the time, it was brand new. And what was interesting about it was that it was a free public library. So we think it's the oldest free public library anywhere in the English-speaking world. Now, that's very important because it means that anybody can come and study in here. It was only open during the week, and it still is only open during the week. But if you've not been here, then come in, because it is one of the most special atmospheres, probably in the northwest of England. It's a Just come into the reading room. When we were in the main body of the library, we passed a series of gates. And these were because people were locked inside, behind the gates, so they couldn't steal the books, because the books were so valuable. In the corner of the reading room, you can just see it in the corner over there, there's a small chest, or cupboard, with the books chained into them. And these were small libraries that were sent out to churches around Manchester. And you can see how they were chained in. So originally they were chained to the shelves because the books were so valuable, so you couldn't even walk very far with them. And then you were locked in, so therefore you couldn't steal any of the books. Because when the library was created, the value of the books was bigger than the whole range of buildings, which shows you how much knowledge was valued compared to bricks and mortar. The reading room here that we're in has got the splendid table in the middle, all original features from the 1630s, but the structures from the 1420s. But the buildings have survived largely because it was a charitable institution. So they didn't really have huge amounts of money to knock it down in the Victorian period and build something grander, which is not normally what would have happened.
If they ask me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how.
Well, the late Victorian period, people just realised how special these buildings were. And like I say, they're not just special because they're ancient and it's a free public library. It's the associations here as well. So you've got Daniel Defoe coming to this library. You've got Benjamin Franklin. You've got Benjamin Disraeli. You've got loads of people called Benjamin, actually. The association with Marx and Engels as well. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. Marx is more famous, but Engels lived for 22 years in Manchester. And you can get the books out here and read what they read. It's still free of charge to visit. So it's still free and public. But it's also a working library. So when we were in the reading room, you saw people working away there and studying. So it's got a life that's beyond just being a historical building. Normally in a National Trust property, maybe, or with due respect to the National Trust or one of the stately homes around Great Britain, you know it's very much now a place to look at and visit. This is alive still with study. And I think that's almost a key element. So it's not just a tourist attraction. It's actually a working building that looks like the perfect tourist attraction. Now, if you just look to one end of the reading room here, you'll see this bay window where there's a square table, lovely square table, you can see it there, with the benches down each side. And we do know that Friedrich Engels and Karl Marx, the two fathers of communism, modern communism, we would say, they sat here and studied. And we know that because in the late 1840s, Engels wrote a letter to Karl Marx saying, can you remember those times we sat here during the 1840s? And we sat, he says, in the alcove, which he means the bay window, at the table, which is still here. You can see it here. So it is a wonderful moment of historical association there, that the two fathers of a world credo which in many respects was short-lived, you know, less than a century, you could say, in terms of its power play, was born in a certain way at this desk. We've got the books out that Marks and Engels read as well, and they are very much involved with the economy of Manchester, how it got its preeminence in industry. So they are really trying to understand this new industry, industrial society, which has this splits between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. I once took, I've taken a couple of Chinese groups around, and some of them weep when they pick up the books of Marx and Engels, because these are official Chinese visitors and they're still Chinese Communist Party members. And it's all here. It's just a great place to sit and contemplate world politics.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
The buildings have an association with John Dee, who is one of the strangest characters of the 1500s. He was a mapmaker. He was a scientist, we'd call him now. He was an absolutely celebrated mathematician, but also he did alchemy, trying to turn base metals into gold. And through those associations, and through his association with a man called Edward Kelly, lots of people thought he was in league with the devil, or there was something wrong with him. He might have been a necromancer, raised the dead. And now we're in the audit room. There's a table. The audit room was where they did the accounts, really, for the town, hence the name. And there's a table, you can see it here, where there's a burn mark, which is a bit shaped like a hoof. So people thought that this is where he raised the devil, and that's the cloven hoof scorched into the wood of the tabletop here. There's even, if you look in the ceiling, a devil's mouth, a mouth of hell, where there's a demon swallowing the soul of an evil human being. So all these little associations have made it quite a spooky location. Six Music listeners may have heard of Dr. Dee, because during Manchester International Festival a couple of goes ago, he wrote this opera called Dr. Dee, English opera, and he came here, Damon Albarn, because it was a place associated with Dr. Dee. How more perfect could that be for inspiration?
When cathedrals they sink into the seas under sand, the ghosts that are left in them, they slip through the hand. When the words in your head and the old man is dead, then our Lord, very hard at the passing of that day, in my life the books of the desert, they turn to sublime. Beware of the emptiness, it plays with the mind. When the goodbye is said and the old man is dead, then our Lord, very hard
at the park, sing of that day. In my
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, for filling us in there. That was a wonderful day of wandering around, finding out what treasures Manchester's libraries has to offer. Something for everyone is the phrase that springs to mind. And we're going to end on Stephen Patrick Morrissey himself. The Cemetery Gates are what we're going to hear now. I wonder if this was penned in Manchester Central Library's beautiful reading room. I'm Guy Garvey. Good afternoon, Mrs. Harrington, the producer of this programme. Was the wonderful Elizabeth Olker. See you next week.
I dreaded sunny days, so I'll meet you at the cemetery gates. Keats and Yeats are on your side. I dreaded sunny days, so I'll meet you at the cemetery gates. Keats and Yeats are on your side. Go inside and we gravely read the stones. All those people, all those lives, where are they now? But with the loves and hates and passions just like mine, they were born and then they lived and then they died. Seems so unfair, I want to cry. You, sir, thrust the sundown salutation to the dawn, and you claim these words as your own. But I've read well and I've heard them said 100 times, maybe less, maybe more. If you must write pros and cons, the words you use should be around. Don't plagiarize or take on loan. But there's always someone somewhere with a big nose who knows and trips you up and laughs when you fall. They'll trip you up and laugh. From whence was ripped some dizzy whore 1804. I dreaded sunny days, so let's go where we're happy and I'll meet you at the cemetery gates. Oh, Keats and Yeats are on your side. I dreaded sunny days, so let's go where we're wanted and I'll meet you at the cemetery gates. Keats and Yeats are on your side, but you lose, 'cause where the love of wine is on the mind.